I'm Dr. Vanessa Sinclair, an artist and psychoanalyst based in Sweden who works with people internationally, and this is episode 285 of Rendering Unconscious Podcast. My guests today are Pablo Lerner and Michael McAndrew. We're here to have a conversation on heterodox psychoanalysis. Rendering Unconscious Podcast received the 2023 Gradiva Award for Digital Media from the National Association for the Advancement for Psychoanalysis. Thank you so very much to all the fans, listeners, and guests of Rendering Unconscious over the past 6 years. We're so honored to have this award. Thank you very much for your support. Brand new news, Rendering Unconscious now has its own Patreon page, which is totally dedicated to all things psychoanalysis, all things Rendering Unconscious. Every week, I'll be posting exclusive content up there about guests, theory, practice, musings, all things psychoanalysis. So join me at patreon.com/ Rendering Unconscious. You can also support the podcast at Substack if you prefer that platform, or by making a donation through PayPal. You can also, if you enjoy psychoanalysis, creativity, and a culture, you can also join me at patreon.com/ Vanessa23Carl, which is my Patreon page with my husband, Carl Abrahamson, where we talk about our magical and creative practices and also post exclusive content there every week. Links to everything can be found in the show notes for this episode, as well as at the main website, renderingunconscious.org. As usual, there is a YouTube video for this discussion. Just visit Trapar Film at YouTube. That's T-R-A-P-A-R-T Film at YouTube. Hi, Pablo and Michael. I'm so glad to have you both here, Rendering Unconscious.
Very happy to be here.
So where shall we begin?
Let's begin with the topic of heterodox psychoanalysis, which in itself is a quite acute question, I think, now that the field of psychoanalysis has split several times, let's say, and become an international phenomenon, and it's take different shapes and form in different countries. We have conflicts everywhere. We have people doing like a really orthodox Lacanianism, Kleinianism, Freudianism, etc. People also try to situate themselves in the middle, try to do something creative with different kinds of psychoanalysts. And then this certainly it's an important topic, not only for psychoanalytic as a field, psychoanalytic theory, but obviously, since psychoanalysis is principally a practice, the practice in psychoanalysts, what this implies on the level of the clinic, but even more, and this I perhaps find the most interesting question of all, but it's because from my experience, psychoanalysts tend to be subjects. And the question of what heterodox, you know, psychoanalysis in the sense that to the extent that it implies some kind of confusion, you know, but this implies or signifies on the level of the subject, of the analyst.
Thankfully, psychoanalysts are subjects.
Thankfully.
Yeah. It strikes me, it's like a... Oh, please, go ahead, Vanessa.
No, I was just going to say, but also end up in group dynamics, just like all other humans, all other subjects.
It's a really Lacanian question to me. It's one of social bond rather than institutional bond or financial bond or a bond of loyalty. Who do you want to work with? Where do you want to work with them? Which is weirdly how Pablo and I met. Well, I emailed him because I was like, this guy's book looks interesting. Okay, he's not a member of the group I was a member of. I don't know him. He was nice enough to answer my email, and we're working together, figuring some things out together in a very non-heterodox way that I appreciate.
Yeah.
I love that. That's what we're all about around here.
Yeah. I think that is one of the most constructive way of developing your own take on psychoanalysis, mm-hmm. to speak to strangers, basically people who you do not know, people who may have different experiences, different countries, different institutions, etc. To speak to people without knowing where it will take you, I think it's absolutely essential, in particular when it comes to heterodox psychoanalysis. It's not just repeating the same concepts, not speaking, as you have said, Michael, several times, just repeating the concepts of signifier, signifier this, signifier that, not speaking with people who will say the same thing as you are supposed to say. And when there is some kind of implicit demand of saying, doing it right, saying it right, these questions are, in a sense, right from the outset, subtracted from this form of encounter, where there is a lot more space for aleatory, events. Things just happen in a way which tend to be less common when the situation is too structured. When there is a point of reference, some kind of guarantee of what's right and wrong. That's nice when talking to strangers.
I think there's a fear of speaking sometimes among analysts. We were talking a little bit about psychoanalytic scenes, New York conferences, and these things. And I find so much that new people in the field don't want to speak, or then people who are really well known are the only people who speak. Like some people do a panel, and then the person who speaks is the person who's written like 7 books, and then maybe somebody who's new doesn't get to ask an interesting question, which might be very different. Nobody even wants to say, "I don't know," which is quite strange.
Yeah.
If you're talking about a subject, the subject doesn't know. And if it's the neurotic subject, there's a powerful desire not to know. But psychoanalysts seem to want to abstain from these things sometimes in the social bond. Myself included at times. I don't want to paint myself as in a different corner here.
Totally. I have to ask, though, since you said you came from different places, different institutes where you trained, what are these places?
No, Pablo, please go ahead.
Well, I come from Sweden. Sweden isn't necessarily the mecca of psychoanalysis.
No.
It exists here, but there aren't any big institutional great tradition. We have in Stockholm, we have the Swedish section of the IPA, which is quite Kleinian, Bionian, Winnicott, and in Gothenburg you have more of an emphasis on Lacan, but there aren't any, real traditions concerning different kinds of schools, except for the IPA, I would say. So in fact, unfortunately and thankfully, I haven't had the experience of passing through this general process of being in a school, doing everything within the framework of a school. I've been in Paris also for 2 years and visited different kinds of schools and events, etc., but I never wanted to participate actively anywhere. So in a sense, I live in some kind of in-between.
You're so lucky.
I know.
Smart.
I don't know if it's smart or not. It was
just how it turned out.
Yeah. I didn't have too many options, And that's my experience. This also implies, of course, that when it comes to developing your own take on psychoanalysis, I am liberated, from transference, basically, to a large extent. And transference, of course, something which is absolutely fundamental of becoming a psychoanalyst. Who is the subject supposed to know? Is the Lacan who wrote this book, so who spoke in the seminar? Is it Freud? But a specific person, who functions as some kind of bearer of the knowledge of psychoanalysis. I haven't necessarily had these persons involved in my life to a big extent. So this lack of transference also has become, I perceive it as a blessing in a sense.
I'd say so. But thank goodness for Per Magnus Johansson for going to Paris and studying and bringing Lacan to Gothenburg.
Yeah. Per Magnus is a hugely important figure for psychoanalysis in Sweden and Gothenburg in particular. I think that his influence is absolutely dependent on him being in Paris for many, many years. Per Magnus Johansson, Swedish psychoanalyst. Yeah, and he, I would consider him a friend of mine, very, very constructive talks. And when I was in Paris, we always took the same stroll for 1 hour by the Seine, you know, in the 7th and 6th arrondissement. But it isn't a transferential relation. It's conditioned by some kind of mutual recognition, which is conditioned also by some kind of recognition of the difference in generations. But it isn't this classical transferential relationship when you subject yourself, in a sense, to that which you suppose that he knows. It's something different. And yeah, speaking about these forms of encounters, you know, with strangers at a certain distance, I would understand it in terms of that. And that is something which I appreciate with him. He and other persons as well. People do not always, I mean, figures of authority in the psychoanalytic field, they do not always subject the subject to the transferential relationship. But they can, you know, give this kind of liberty and freedom for you to do your own thing. And this, I think, creates excellent conditions for a form of dialogue, which is absolutely open and leaves the door open for confusion also.
You know, when I first moved to Sweden, I had imagined leaving New York and going to Stockholm. I would set up something similar, like have an office and like get events going or things like that. But I found that there's not as much momentum. It's not as easy to get momentum going in Sweden as it is in New York. It was like everyone was just like, meh. Like really, people were really like in their thing, and like they have no interest in moving out of that thing. They were just like, "Nope, I'm comfortable here. That's fine. Nothing new." I think
that's really a shame to be stuck in one thing. I mean, for myself, I had a counter experience to Pablo. I've always been, since I began my clinical studies and continuing with my clinical work, oriented to a school of Lacan, usually an international school. For a long time, for me, that was one certain Lacanian school, although these days I find my work more oriented by people like the Lacanian Compass, but I also have been taking seminars with the Freud-Lacan Institute. So for me, working with people at great distance has never been an issue. It's always been sort of something I took for granted rather than just be, you know, tied to one scene of New York and Sweden, although we have a surprisingly thriving psychoanalytic community in Colorado. I don't know why Colorado. People, patients, just analysands off the street really like to be in analysis. I don't know if they like it all the time, but they certainly go. So it's quite remarkable to be like at a slight remove from never having been part of like, I guess, a mainstream scene, but still fundamentally Lacanian. This is one of the reasons I think I struck up this relationship with Pablo is I read his work. Well, at first I was intrigued by the work. I was like, what in the hell is this? It's 130 pages. How can this guy go past Lacan? His name's Pablo. He lives in Sweden. I gotta hear more.
What's going on here?
Yeah, I was like, I've never heard of this guy, but his ideas are very interesting. And, you know, in spite of your own counter experience of this way, Pablo, I consider your work to be fundamentally psychoanalytic and something that I think more people should be familiar with. Particularly in its view of the clinic, which offers, I think, something very different than either these IKEA, that's a Swedish thing, right? IKEA how-to clinical guides or, you know, some very austere theoretical book. It's a clinical book to me very much. Now, that's my reading of your work. You're welcome to say if you have a different opinion of your work. But I found it to be refreshing, and the kind of social bond that can be established at that remove from the mainstream to be very important.
Yeah. Yeah, and I agree with you told you. We spoke about this earlier. I was very, very happy about how you read the book. It is indeed a book on psychoanalytic practice more than everything else. I conceive of psychoanalysis as a practice, not a theory. Although there is a lot of theory in it, you have also read it, Vanessa. But one of the aims, of course, in the reading experience of this book is confusion, in a sense, situating, you know, the reader in a state of I do not know, what is this, how should I take this, is this what, you know, which I perceive of as being fundamental for the psychoanalyst as such, you know, and reflects in a sense also the psychoanalytic situation, not only for the analysand, you know, where confusion obviously is a necessary step, mm-hmm. you know, in doing your analysis, but also for the psychoanalysts, you know, also for the psychoanalysts, certainly to a certain degree in every psychoanalysis, there are always these very, very constructive and important moments of surprise. You know, what is this? You know, these moments are essential. If you want to, you know, be a bit simplistic, you could see psychoanalysis as a series of surprises, you know. But yeah, also finding your own way of situating yourself in relation to psychoanalysis requires a certain degree of confusion. Mm-hmm. And this chapter, you know, metaphorically at least, I speak of in terms of internal exile. Exile is particularly of finding yourself in a state of exile in relation also to psychoanalysis. And this I believe to be absolutely crucial. Which is crucial is how should I put it? You have to, hopefully, you know, when you go through psychoanalysis, things having to do with a transracial relationship, you pass through that. After a while, you mm-hmm. stop situating the analyst in the position of the subject supposed to know. Mm-hmm. You go through the confusion, etc. This also has to be the case, obviously, for the psychoanalyst.
Mm-hmm.
The psychoanalyst, when they go to analysis, obviously, but also when it comes to psychoanalysis itself.
Absolutely.
You know, you tend to establish these transferential relationship to psychoanalysts, to different blah, blah, blah. And psychoanalysis is a theory, different figures, different theorists, etc. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's obvious that you have to liberate yourself from psychoanalysis mm-hmm. in order to be free in psychoanalysis. Yeah, well, hopefully, if you have gone through your own psychoanalysis as a psychoanalyst, then you find some kind of value in it. You have some kind of faith that it may work, etc. So hopefully the experience of going through psychoanalysis as a psychoanalyst or, you know, psychoanalyst in process doesn't lead you to reject it wholly, but to liberate yourself from the question of what it means to be a psychoanalyst, you know, to liberate yourself from that question in order to become it. You know?
I think I've seen that can be quite surprising for some colleagues who realize they don't want to be a psychoanalyst at all. And so they go do something else, or maybe they stick to being a therapist or do something like that, or do something completely different. It's a good question. I don't have an answer. How do you have some surprises in an institute or a school? Certainly in institutes of the IPA, and I have some dear friends and colleagues there, so I don't want to pick on them too much, but there's a sequence of coursework, and when you're done the coursework, when you've completed your analysis, that means you're an analyst. That's not surprising. It just means if you stick with it, then you get authorized at the guarantee of the other. But how would you introduce a surprise into an institute like that? I know we both work with the IPA in different ways, different constituent organizations. Where do you put a surprise in there? Who wants to be surprised is a good question.
I don't think institutes want surprise. I felt totally dead inside when I was in the institute. That's what the effect it had on me. It was just like, I just felt like completely dead. And then every like time we'd have a conference or a lecture to go to, I just feel like everything was so dead. Everything was so dead and dry. And that's why, like Pablo said, I think before we were recording, when we started Das Umbehagen, at some point we realized it's me, Jameson Webster, and this guy, Michael Garfinkel, were all at the same institute, New York Psychoanalytic Institute, which is like the Mecca in New York. and where all the other institutes split off from there. But we were just there and we were like we know all these like great analysts, you know, we have the internet nowadays. We could just like email them. And when we'd hear like someone like Danny Nobis or Darian Leader, somebody was coming to New York to give a talk at a university or something, we would just email them and be like, hey, we're like this group of like, you know, psychoanalyst information that want to like work outside institutes and like bring more like life to psychoanalysis. Like, will you come talk to our group? And everybody did, you know, and even our very first talk was with Otto Kernberg, which is like kind of amazing now in like retrospect.
That's a surprise. Yeah.
Like he was just like, sure, I'll come, you know, and like nobody charged us for anything or anything. They just like were happy to talk to some analyst information that were like, trying to have a life inside of this kind of structure.
I've actually been really surprised, and I've not worked a great deal in New York. It's a little too cold for me. I mean, even though I live in Colorado, but I've been working with these people in Kansas, in the Greater Kansas Topeka Psychoanalytic Institute. And I'm so surprised that they're happy to have a Lacanian come and give some talks and talk with them, comment on cases. I don't know how many of them knew what a Lacanian was beyond they knew it was related to this French guy and his waiting room and his short sessions. But that was very surprising to me how open people can be to this if you just, I think, approach in the spirit of wanting to work together.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the thing I got most out of being in the Institute was that I understood Lacan better in his, like, what he was running away from, from his ego psychologist analyst. Because yeah. I had an ego psychologist analyst, and I was just is not analysis. Like, what is this? Mm-hmm. Like, he was giving advice and these very long interpretations, and I was like, he's like talking half my session, you know, telling me, like, when I would get upset, like, he was like comforting me and telling me how great I was. Boy. And I was like, this is not. Thankfully, I had an analysis during graduate school in Miami. That was like, I was with a candidate, and so it was like 4 times a week for like $10 a session or something. Yeah, it was graduate school. I was broke. And so luckily that analysis was really good. And I think he was so good because I actually have sent people to him since then and they were not so pleased, but I think it was really good because he was a candidate and he was probably not talking. Like, he barely talked at all. And like, when he did say something, it was usually something like really good, where I was like, that like really like, you know, was a good thing to say at that moment. But it was so rare. It's like, I don't even know if he said anything every session, you know, and he just like kind of let me do my own work. And so when I got to this ego psychologist analyst, who's like a training analyst at this fancy institute, blah, 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 and everybody loved him and whatever. And, you know, and he was just like talking the whole time. I was like, this is not psychoanalysis. And then I felt like this is what Lacan was running away from. And that was basically how I got out of there too, was we started Unbehagen, but also Jameson Webster brought David Lichtenstein to come to our institute to like give a little mini course on Lacan that you could take as kind of like an elective, you know, thing. Nice. And once I started reading Lacan, I was like, yeah, what am I doing here? You know, I'm like, I can't read Autofenicol anymore.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the price, because most of my work is in a pro bono clinic for women who have experienced pregnancy loss, child loss, these things. And I do a lot of low fee analysis in the community as well. Like, I really try to expand a pro bono and low fee clinic. And I think that's certainly against the psychoanalytic heterodoxy. Like, I'm guessing you paid this great ego psychologist more than $10 a session.
Yeah.
Probably considerably more. And it's such a funny thing. Psychoanalysts are so funny about money, where it's like somehow an analysis is less if it's low fee. But it sounds like you had this really good experience with this guy in Florida. I don't know if he's a guy. I assume he's a guy in Florida.
It was.
Yeah, sure. But there's so many people who would say, well, that's a candidate's analyst. And that's, you know, a training person. We don't. That's not the real stuff of this ego psychologist who talks too much.
Yeah, no, he was so much better. And I'm so glad I had that experience, or else I would have maybe thought that was what analysis was, you know, and maybe would have stayed there to my own detriment. And yeah, it's another good point. Like, I was able to do that because I worked at a hospital at the time and I actually had government insurance. And because he was a psychiatrist, nice. the ego psychologist, he actually took my insurance through the government. And so the insurance actually paid 4 times a week and I just had a copay, which was amazing. Mm-hmm. But like, how do people do it otherwise? You know what I mean? Like, I was very lucky to have that situation. But like, yeah, how do people afford like that kind of expensive analysis during training? And they have to pay for supervision and all of this stuff. It's really like, yeah, it makes it very much for the elite, you know.
I mean, I've always had my own analysis. I always controlled my cases and been involved in didactics. But I've always been outside of a formalized institute in that way. So it was not a cost in that way for me. But also, I see most of the people I see 2, 3, 4 times a week. It's just for a fee probably closer to what you were paying in Florida, which is, to me, still a very Lacanian analysis. Like, I practice the short session. There's no reason people can't do it that way. It's just, they haven't thought to, like with you and Dasubahegan and your colleagues, like, why hadn't somebody done that before? Because they never thought of it. Then it was thought of, then it was spoken, then it was done.
Yeah, now we have more opportunity than ever to connect because we're all remote and we can connect this way. So to me, there's this is like a really great opportunity for psychoanalysis, especially like it's not as super regulated as like, say, psychology in the U.S. You know, you can work across like country borders. And yeah, it's like a great time for psychoanalysis in that way where I think it could be really grow. And I think it is really growing. And we can have institutes, like you said, Lacanian Compass, there's Lacan Salon in Vancouver always doing events, and the Freud Lacan Institute out of Dublin, there's out of Australia. There's like so many different places that you can go to study groups and lectures and things without having to be in the same place.
Or even find an analyst if you don't want to work with somebody in your area. If you're like live in, you know, God forbid, Oklahoma or something. Sorry if there's any viewers in Oklahoma, but maybe there's no analyst in Oklahoma you want to work with. Maybe there's no analyst at all. I have no idea. Well, you could find somebody, and I'm sure they'd be willing to work with you with some, you know, some contingency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyhow, I was thinking about this because as you say, Michael, you know, I came to think of the idea and then I did it, basically. You know, it's sometimes we tend to complicate things for ourselves. You know, things are sometimes quite easy, quite simple. When it comes to action, obviously life's difficult. You know, there's a lot of obstacles. You cannot do whatever you want. You know, this kind of dream of the free, you know, I don't believe in that. But so as long as you do not relate to that which is right, things are quite simple, you know, just to do them. But it requires, once again, some kind of liberty from orthodoxy. And I was thinking about this question about surprise in the institution once more. Where does the surprise come from? First of all, from your own psychoanalysis, you know. And there we can also understand that we do not want the surprise in a psychoanalytic institution for the simple fact that surprise, by definition, at least the psychoanalytic surprise, you know, the lapse, for example, it proves that you're wrong. And this is the thing also in becoming a psychoanalyst and working psychoanalytically more heterodox, you know, it almost requires that you're doing things wrong. Not as an act of transgression, you know, it's in a sense, it's only in the eyes of the law that the heretic, you know, becomes a transgressor.
Sure.
But doing it within quotation marks, relatively independent of what's right and wrong, which, you know, just doing it. And as a consequence of that, given that you're doing it in a relatively genuine way, you know, doing it wrong in relation to different kinds of position. If you situate yourself in relation to many different points of view, you're bound to do it wrong. You know, you will do it wrong. And that can bother you to a greater or lesser extent. I can be absolutely horrified about not interpreting the transference, for example. If I would be a client, I would be absolutely horrified. If I speak at all, if I would be some kind of a psychoanalyst who thinks that interpretation is violence, for example. Whatever I do it wrong if I have many points of reference which I recognize. And once again, to liberate yourself from this is important. But my question to you guys also is, you know, this experience of the surprise as an act, as a happening of being incorrect, of proving yourself, you know, wrong, to what degree is it compatible, you know, with an institution as such? In particular, in the case of psychoanalysis, where no one has, as far as I know, no psychoanalyst has direct access to the unconscious, you know, and psychoanalysts at the same time, since we're not, you know, surgeons, for example, we are also bound to fail, you know, and it's inevitable to fail as a psychoanalyst many times. I wouldn't say it's the rule, or it's nothing like that. It's just, it's inevitable. You will fail. And this necessity of confronting failure on the one hand, and on the other hand, not knowing exactly what the unconscious is, which is the fundamental concept around which our practice revolves. You know, to what degree can the experiences having to do with this, you know, be lifted into a psychoanalytic institution in order to produce, you know, the preconditions for the surprise and the confusion. You know, this is a question which I wouldn't say that it bothers me or preoccupies me, but when I think about a psychoanalytic institution which I would like to be a part of, it would certainly be like this.
It's interesting to think about that practicing in the institute, because this is why they expelled Lacan for introducing surprise, for using the cut. Mm-hmm. You know, there's that, I think, an invalid criticism, like, well, he just wanted more money. He had money. Well, he just wanted more patience. He had patience. No, but I mean, the short session can be extraordinarily surprising for people. It's not like it introduces something of the unconscious. It introduces that access of the unconscious to the analysis, and not with that, you know, wonderful ego psychologist you spoke about, Vanessa, who was like, oh, this is how you're really feeling. And I don't know, I'm probably like your father or something. I'm assuming. Yeah. Right. But for them to say it and hear it, and then maybe for the candidate to say it and hear it, if you know, it is such a place of candidacy, or the analyst in formation. But then it's a better question for me, and I this is another question I don't have an answer for, how to introduce a cut within the institution beyond the analyses one is conducting with people in that institution. That's rather than just say a split, which might not do anything, because maybe some splits are good, maybe some splits don't do anything, and it's just the same thing will get repeated in a different place. It's an open question for me, this idea of the institution and its splits.
I'm generally like, I don't want to tell other people what to do in general, and just everyone can find their own way. And like, if they want to be in an institute or whatever, that's fine. But at this point, I'm kind of like an institute abolitionist, where I really feel like institutes are like antithetical to psychoanalysis, except for I really like what the Freud-Lacan Institute is doing, but they're not also not set up. I mean, they're also new, but I also just love all those people. And I feel like they could do a training. Like, I don't think that training is impossible, but I feel like at least my experience in New York, it's like, in order to tell people that they have to go through this training, and like, I mean, they even made a sign in like to class, you know, and this is an institute that you have to be a doctor already. So it was only PhDs, PsyDs, and MDs, you know? So we're all like went through either graduate school or medical school already. And then we're like working at the hospital all day, seeing our own patients in the evening, going to our own analysis, and then going to class at this place on the Upper East Side from like 8 p.m. to 10 p.m., you know? And then like, when I asked them, I was like, why do we have to sign in for class? They're like, well, how else do we know that you're really committed? It's like, well, we're here.
Oh, boy.
Like, we could just work as doctors in hospitals and not be doing this right now. It's just absurd.
I mean, by that time, almost all of you would have been like north of 30 or close to it. You're signing
Exactly. It was like 35, 40. One of my friends, like his wife was having a baby. And like, and if we missed more than three classes, they didn't let that class count like for that semester. And one of his wife was having a baby, and they had like, oh, they thought the baby was coming and it didn't. So he missed the class. And then the baby actually came. So he missed the class. And so he missed like three classes, and they made him repeat the class. It's just like,
That's quite absurd.
It's absurd.
It's an interesting signifier, an institute, because it implies a kind of a hierarchy. Who's the hierarchy for? Who does it serve? Like I'm interested in this New York psychoanalytic process. So this training analyst, you were assigned him, or did you pick him?
Oh, you're going to love this. I love that you want me to talk about this, because I can talk about this forever.
I'm very interested.
I'm so disgruntled. But I interviewed with him as the candidate to go into the institute, and he requested to be my analyst.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's gross.
He doesn't listen to this, does he?
I don't think so.
Okay. That's That's such an inversion of the demand, though. That's so strange to me. I mean, yeah, make an offer, open the door, but don't say, get in here. That's really odd. But
yeah, and then there's no way to get out of it, because then, like, if you can't end your analysis, because you have to be, like, in this analysis with one of their training analysts in order to graduate, right? And then if I would complain about the analysis or like, yell at him or something, he'd be like, well, you can just switch analysts. And it's like, to what? To another one that's just like you. You know what I mean? Like, you're all the same here. You're all like this.
But I mean, that it's such a strange thing. One should have the freedom to choose their own analyst, to work with who they want, rather than, I mean, I feel like I'm preaching to the choir here, but yeah, of course, rather than somebody who's assigned to you or demands you be assigned to them. That's very, that's very antithetical, I think, to a psychoanalytic orientation. I mean, people chose to be an analyst with people other than Freud. Sometimes they did ask Freud, and he was like, nah, take a walk, go see this guy, but... that it's such a question of demand to me.
Yeah, exactly. Because in this situation, which is absolutely absurd, I think, it's some kind of explicit demand, but it's always implicitly there in every institution. Perhaps you have the freedom to choose, but basically you're choosing something which is supposed to be general. You know, there is something in particular subjects or particular analysts which is supposed to be the same, which is absolutely fundamental for the logic of the institution. Of course, but I was thinking about abolishing everything, abolishing it.
Just all of it.
Just the institutes. How about not the online institutes?
What would
or just keep the Freud Lacan Institute, because I love them.
What would the alternative be, even, is it? To institutes? No. Because I certainly believe in the value of having venues where you can dialogue, basically. And I ask myself what kind of venues exist, which aren't, you know, subjected to the institutional logic, where things tend to be determined by this demand, explicit or implicit. I wonder what the alternatives could be.
Yeah, because I feel like what you did is ideal, because, like, okay, you luckily had Per Magnus Johansson in Gothenburg. You could study with him and get into Lacan. And then you could go over to Paris for a couple of years and go to talks and lectures. And I don't know how you did your analysis, but whatever. You can, like, choose your analyst, choose your supervisor, talk to colleagues, go to lectures that interest you. I feel like at some point it's the same thing where you have to understand that you're going to, at some point, your desire, you're going to want to continue to learn about psychoanalysis on your own, you know? And so, like, maybe the Institute can, like, get people started with, like, these are some fundamental texts, but it should be with in mind that, like, you know, you should be going to lectures and reading people that you find of interest, you know, and letting yourself, like, develop yourself in that way, where instead of being like, that program I went to was like 4 years. You have to take these classes. They weren't even organized, so that, like, 1 week there was, like, the same paper assigned from two different teachers. And, like, by my third year, my first year, there was six of us. And then, like, two of the other women got pregnant. And so they went part-time and someone else went part-time. So the second year, there was, like, three of us in my class. And then by the third year, there was only me and this one other guy. And, like, we had heard everything each other had to say. And he was, like, super into the institutional structure and, like, you know, please, master, I'm your whatever. And, like, he was a psychiatrist. He also had a PhD in neuropsychology. So he was like a masochist.
And you said to spend had a PhD in neuropsychology,
then went to become a psychiatrist, and then went to analytic training. He just, like, wanted to be subjected forever. But but anyway, we just, like, didn't agree on anything. It's like, how much am I going to learn talking to this guy? And, like, I remember, like, one class, this teacher was like, you know, why aren't you saying much? It's like, well, because we already talked about this paper on Monday. You know, like, you guys aren't organized in what you're doing. And then my very last one, I had, like, a few points of, like, I can't take this anymore. And one was that we had a teacher who was supposedly teaching Freud. We had, like, Freud classes, which I liked, you know, we're going through Freud kind of chronologically, all the major works. And he was teaching Beyond the Pleasure Principle, but he was, like, an evolutionary biologist, psychiatrist teaching Beyond the Pleasure Principle. And it was the last class of the whole semester. And we didn't have time to, like, get to everything he wanted to get to. So he literally told us, like, should we read Beyond the Pleasure Principle and go over it in one class, by the way, in an hour and a half, or should we read this paper by me that I wrote in this journal? And I was like, I think we should read the Freud, you know? And of course, the other guy was like, oh, no, teacher, let's read your paper. And so he's like, okay, we'll go over both.
I can't believe you did this for minutes. 4 years. That's crazy. You did this for 4 years. That's crazy.
I did it for 3 years. I did not make it to the fourth year. I snapped. I was like, I can't. But anyway, in that class, when he was teaching Beyond the Pleasure Principle, he then got to the death drive, and he was like, this is what Freud, he basically told us that Freud was like demented, like had lost his mind. And so like, this part doesn't make sense and you don't have to read Freud after this. I was like, why are you teaching Freud if this is what you think, you know? And then so, the other guy was like, oh, but it's evolution. It doesn't make sense that anything would evolve to have a death drive. And I was like, why are you psychoanalysts?
Well, that's such a good question, because I assume this was for the LP qualification, right? Or something like this, like to be a registered analyst.
Yeah, they
or
have that now. That wasn't happening when I was in training.
But it's a newer thing. The idea of the legal or political guarantee of a psychoanalyst is so strange to me, or of having to work with some people. Like, maybe it's very American of me, but I very much believe in that freedom of movement, that literal free association to work with people you choose to work with without, having to do this for whatever. I mean, by licensure, I'm a counselor, but that's not a hard thing to be. I can just call myself an analyst because of various things.
Because you are.
There's no board of psychoanalysis in Colorado. Hopefully there never will be, because I would be having to move,
because that is messing people up now having the license. And like, now you have to be licensed to practice, and how's that going to work? It's like,
well, I've heard colleagues in those kind of states or institutes, and they say, well, I can't really do analysis because I don't have the legal qualification. I'm like,
what does that mean?
Maybe I should talk to my lawyer before I say this, but who's going to know when you close the door, like whether you're using the couch or something?
What's the difference between doing analysis or you're just going to do therapy instead, you know?
Sure.
The insurance companies don't pay for psychoanalysis anyway, you know?
What's that mean? You can't say the word unconscious to somebody? If they bring you a dream, you have to be like, well, listen, I got 6 months left in my training. Write that one down and bring it back later.
Yeah.
So
but I was thinking like it sounds like all three of us are in favor of some kind of enduring, some kind of in-betweenness in the field of psychoanalysis. And I wonder if there could be some kind of band of psychoanalytic vagabonds or not. But the question, of course, becomes how can you be a psychoanalyst, or how can you say that you are a psychoanalyst if you choose the route of the vagabond? And hopefully you choosing this path enables you to be less preoccupied by it, you know, and you can also perhaps choose to call yourself a psychoanalyst. Many persons see it as some kind of honorary title or some kind of legal thing. I don't think you should perceive it as that. It's a job, basically. We shouldn't, you know, make things bigger than they are. We're doing basically speaking to patients, listening to them, you know, in the spirit, whatever that means of certain psychoanalysts and blah, blah, blah. But hopefully choosing this vagabond path enables you to be less preoccupied by this, and perhaps calling yourself this, not because of some kind of guarantee, but because it's reasonable to do it. Because why not? Because what else should I call myself, you know?
Sure.
I also think in America, it's a very American preoccupation, because people in Europe don't seem to be as preoccupied with this. But America is so preoccupied with, like, what are the rules? What is the law? You know, because of all the different states and all the different rules and everything.
Well, if people ask me what I do, I say I'm a psychoanalyst because, yeah, I have a counseling licensure, but it's not an accurate description of what I do. I don't do anything in the way of counseling anybody. I don't really tell people what to do. I don't have a lot of good advice for them. So I say I'm a psychoanalyst. And people get intrigued by this, though. I think the patients are more interested in analysis sometimes than the analysts in formation, the people doing the training, who are preoccupied with these questions of, you know, where do I fit in the Institute? What does this mean for me? It's good to orient yourself in these things if you want them, but beyond that, maybe not.
And this is the thing. I've had some encounters with you know, important figures in psychoanalysis who aren't that preoccupied about the question of being an important figure in psychoanalysis. For example, someone who is a part of a psychoanalytic institute may be, you know, the guardian of the law of the institute and the you know, etc. But they can also not care so much, you know, about the institute. They are granted that liberty, I suppose, by coming to that level. But it's a huge difference if you are within the framework of an institute to go into psychoanalysis with someone who perceives the aim of the analysis, amongst other things, is to become an analyst of the school, for example, to get some kind of, you know, some kind of certificate or something like that. Be recognized and accepted by the institute as a psychoanalyst, and on the other hand, have an analyst who says to you, or so makes you understand, or you know, directs the treatment in some form of direction, which makes you understand and feel that the question "I want to become an analyst" is the wrong question. Mm-hmm. You know, it's absolutely the wrong question when you enter into analysis. I suppose I understand. People do it, but you have to liberate yourself from the question.
Yeah, I think that when I say that I want to I'm kind of an abolitionist of institutes at this point. This is exactly why, because I feel like if you go into analysis with this idea that you are doing it for this reason, you know, to graduate this program, to be this thing and buying into this whole like social order, hierarchical order, I don't feel like these are real analyses. Like when I did my first analysis, I didn't have to do that. When I went to graduate school, I assumed, because I liked Freud and Jung and stuff, that like I was going to go there and you had to go through therapy to become a psychologist. I was in a clinical psychology program, but it was not analytic at all. But they had like a group of analysts and therapists that would do reduced fee, you know, sessions for students or whatever, like at the main office, and you could look through that and pick one or whatever. So that's what I did. But it was because of my desire. I drove myself to do that. And my school was an hour away, and I drove down to Miami an hour every day to go there and then an hour back, you know, and I did that work. But I feel like when you have this kind of goal in mind at the outset, I feel like maybe that's why there's so many bad analysts. Like, are these people really analyzed? Because they haven't gotten to that place where they realize I'm not the subject that knows, you know, like, you know, other people might really put me in that place as master, but I'm not a master. I don't know any more than anybody else, you know?
Exactly. And this is the point also, which Lacan makes in the first seminars. He speaks of concerning ego psychology, that the aim of analysis is to identify with the ego of the analyst, you know, which is, yeah, exactly. But that
we were taught that, by the way.
End of the really?
Yeah.
Well, that's good. But the end of analysis, you know, in this sense, is alienation. You know, the end of analysis is not, you know, some kind of relative liberty from alienation, but alienation is the point where you want to come in. Mm-hmm. And the problem, obviously, is that, like in an institutional function like this, you know, if you want to become an analyst, you know. In many relatively orthodox psychoanalytic institutions, what you have to do basically is identify with the analyst. What you basically have to do is alienate yourself into, you know, this kind of conception of what an analysis is, of how we should think, etc. And this is, I agree with you totally, this creates a certain distance, you know, from that which is absolutely essential for a psychoanalyst, which is the opposite of alienation. I do not know what it is. Perhaps you could speak of it as surprise. Perhaps you could speak of it as full speech. Perhaps, I don't know, confusion, certainly. But to gain access to this, you know, is absolutely essential for me, crucial to become a good analyst, you know, to become a good analyst. The patient will certainly feel the difference, you know, if the analyst is, you know, I wouldn't say authentic in the Heideggerian way, you know, because it's a weird concept, but let's speak like in everyday terms, genuine. You know, genuine. If the analyst, for example, is genuinely funny, You know, for example, if they make an interpretation in the form of the wit in accordance with Lacan's theory of the wit, it can be an extremely boring wit. And it can be a wit which is supposed to be boring, but it's still even more, you know, it's just boring, it's just bad. It's a wit that doesn't function, you know. But you can be genuinely extremely funny and serious at the same time and make an excellent interpretation, which is genuine, and it is just because of the genuineness of it that it is received as such, you know.
That can also be an excellent punctuation, a joke. It's a perfect way to scan a session. It's coming back around to me, this idea of surprise in the Analytic Institute. And one thing I've been reading a lot of lately are some testimonies of the past. And one I recall reading last night, the author's name escapes me. This is a person in France, I believe, though. They were surprised they were going to do the pass. They had left their analysis like a year ago or a year before they decided to do so, and something happened. They heard some phrase, they saw something, and were like, oh, of course, okay. That's something one produces on their own, though. Yes, as a result of the analysis, the end of the analysis, or some way of concluding, but, you know, in many of these testimonies I read that seem to produce an analyst or judges having done so, there is surprise. There's a lot of surprise in the end. But that's not going to happen in, you know, certain kind of institutional analysis where somebody really does just want to identify with the analyst or an analyst or the idea of being the analyst. This is what a Lacanian does. This is what a Freudian does. This is what a Kleinian does. This is what I do because I'm in this institute. No, but to find, institute or not, to find your own way in these things is quite interesting. Yeah. That's a surprise. That's the cut that's introduced, perhaps, in the past.
Absolutely. And I'm going to plug the Freud-Lacan Institute one more time while we're here. I also like what they're doing because I love all of the Dubliners. But I think it's also like done in a way that's thoughtful for people in their career. It's on Saturdays, once a month, for 2 years. You know, this is doable. You know, you could go, you do a morning lecture seminar, you have lunch, and then in the afternoon you do supervision, you know, and then after 2 years, once a month, you know, you've done their program. And I feel like that's a really good, all the people presenting lecturers are incredible. They're like all my favorite Lacanians, you know, and like, yeah, it's doable. It's accessible. It's on the weekend. It's online. So people can do it from anywhere. And I think they've thought about like what is realistic, because people are already in their careers, already in their jobs. It's not too demanding. Gives people a good solid base to get going, and then hopefully like sparks their desire and they'll keep studying in their analytic career, you know?
Yeah, I really also like what they're doing over there. I found them to be very, very warm people, very funny people too. The lectures are pretty early for me. It's about at 3 a.m. starting here.
Yeah, but, I know. I saw it was totally dark.
I'm just like,
what time is it? It's like 2 in the morning.
It was like 3. I was walking to my office at 2:30. But that's my desire to do so.
Yeah.
I wanted to do that. And I would definitely encourage people to check that out also if they're interested.
I will link to it.
Eve is pretty cool. Yeah.
And also, oops, I just realized it's 1 minute. I have a patient going to call. Also, check out Pablo's book, and I'll link to the episode that Pablo is on talking about it, though. But we'll plug it one more time, too. Speculating on the Edge of Psychoanalysis, Rings and Voids, which kind of sparked this discussion.
Thanks, Vanessa. I kind of am quite of partial, but I agree with you.
Well, thank you guys both for being here. I'm glad we got to do this.
Yeah, thank you, Vanessa. Thank you,
Pablo. You're welcome back anytime. Just email me anytime you want to come back and have more speculative discussion.
All right.
Thank you. Guys, have a lot of fun. Take care now.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Rendering Unconscious. You've just heard a discussion with Pablo Lerner and Michael McAndrew. For more, visit previous episodes with Pablo Lerner, Rendering Unconscious episode 182 and episode 263. As well, I've linked to the Freud-Lacan Institute so you can check out what they're doing and what Michael and I were talking about. As always, links to everything can be found in the show notes as well as at renderingunconscious.org. Huge thanks to Carl Abrahamson for creating the intro and outro music for Rendering Unconscious podcast. You can follow him at carlabrahamson.com. That's Carl with a C and Abrahamson with two S's. And now the song, Disturbance, from the album of the same name, a collaboration I did with UK Sonic Mastermind, Pete Murphy. Available at petemurphy.bandcamp.com. You can also find our music streaming at Spotify and other streaming services. Just search for Vanessa Sinclair and Pete Murphy. Enjoy. Disturbances. I'll ask you. It's night. Many parts. And decay and death. Have a spine. Our perceptions. Sitting alone, seemingly at a loss, she flies over. Pandrogyny continues on after death. Lady J. The unconscious, what you have now reclaimed. Come back in dreams. Before. Disturbance. She throws her head back and whimpers with pain. Pierre is watching, the cigarette hanging. She was still. He whispered. Androgyny and thee all makes sense eventually.